What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and families and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men face sexual aggression of some sort on college campuses annually in the United States. Doctors Johnson and Birdall, husband and wife and co-authors of Warning Signs, How to Protect Your Kids from Becoming Victims or Perpetrators of Violence and Aggression. Join 411 Teen this hour. Dr. Brian Johnson is a licensed child and adolescent psychologist, parenting expert, and full professor at the University of North Colorado. This is his second book with his wife, Dr. Lori Birdall, an obstetrics and gynecology physician, retired almost after 20 years of practice. She retired due to a permanently disabling condition. Warning Signs, How to Protect Your Kids from Becoming Victims or Perpetrators of Violence and Aggression was released nationwide August 1st, 2016. Doctors Birdall and Johnson, welcome to 411 Teen. It's great to have you back. I look forward to talking with you.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's great to be with you again, Dr. Liz.
Okay. The concept of rape dates to Greek mythology, when to rape a person meant to capture the person for the purpose of enslavement. In the United States, there's no national rape law. Instead, each state drafts its own laws to deal with sexual aggression. The White House Task Force to Protect Students from Sexual Assault reported a chilling statistic. 1 in 5 college students experiences sexual assault during their college career. Doctors Birdall and Johnson, would you share with us just what sexual aggression is? I know it's a wide range of kind of forced, unwanted sexual activities. But would you elaborate on that for us, please?
Yeah, that's a good first starting point because it can get confusing with all the terms. Basically, sexual violence is the term I think most commonly used to describe any sexual sort of misconduct or harm. And that's what's used by the World Health Organization now and many of the national health groups. And it doesn't include any unwanted sexual act that can be a non-contact sexual experience that might comprise comments alone or exposing someone who doesn't want to be exposed to sexual materials. Like pornographic material, and sometimes this constitutes a legal charge of sexual harassment when it happens at school or a work place. And then there's sexual assault, which is a contact, intentional sexual contact crime, either directly skin-to-skin or through the clothing of a person's private areas. And then there is rape or attempted rape, and U.S. Department of Justice changed their definition a while back to include any sort of penetration with a body part or an object. And then there's sexual violence also incorporates this horrible problem we have now, sexual trafficking, where vulnerable kids, oftentimes taken from poor nations or even here in America who are runaways or otherwise troubled kids, are enticed into basic sexual servitude or slavery, and that's incorporated too. But I think when we talk, so that's sexual violence, but I think when we talk about sexual aggression, that's more of a general sort of pressure to engage in sexual activity by someone who feels entitled to sex and therefore aggressively pursues victims. And so it can be, you know, something as simple as, you know, continuing to harass someone until they consent. So it is a wide net when we talk about aggression and violence. But it's all unwanted attention and can even include assault and rape.
And I really am glad that you included that it did not always involve physical contact.
Yes.
I think that's important to hear because we're talking about things like voyeurism, exhibitionism.
Yes.
These count. They're unwanted sexual attention.
Yes, yes.
And that's important that our listening audience understand that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think even things like leering,
mm-hmm.
you know, at a woman's breasts or bottom or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's unwanted. It's harmful. It feels like an intrusion, and it's an example of being victimized.
Now, when we're talking about sexual aggression on campus, what I found is that many of the victims may be coerced by the use of some substance. It's not the typical kind of aggression that we think of where you're walking alone and the individual, you don't know who they are, they're a stranger. No, that's not the case. So I would like you to share with the listening audience, if you would, the characteristics of someone who is likely, I know we can't always predict, but who is likely to commit a sexually violent crime, if you will?
Sure. I mean, I think that, like you were saying, that oftentimes alcohol and drug use is involved in people who perpetrate these types of activities, but they also tend to have low empathy for other people, particularly their victims. Oftentimes they have a history of disrespect for women, like their mothers or their sisters. And they have just this general aggressiveness where they accept violence as being an acceptable way to get your wants or get your needs met. Other factors that are associated with individuals who perpetrate these kinds of activities on college campuses include a history of juvenile delinquency. So even though they maybe weren't ever arrested or never got in trouble for their activities, they still engaged in it. Bullying of other people is a common mm-hmm. characteristic that we'll sometimes see. Also, oftentimes there's this early sexual initiation where they become sexually active at a younger age relative to other college-age students. And there's this preference for sexually explicit or violent media as well. So those are some of the factors. Others can include things like adhering to and believing rape myths and sexual stereotypes, a belief in traditional gender roles, and a preference for impersonal sexual activity.
And many, when we're looking at the college campuses, many of the victims may know are know of, I guess I should say, their assailant.
Right.
I mean, I think it's about 2 out of 3 sexual assaults are committed on an attacker who's out of this category that they know or know of, know indirectly through a friend of.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I think really reflects just a general disrespect or disregard for women. And when we talk about this topic, we often qualify it by saying, hey, you know, sexual violence does occur against boys and men.
Mm-hmm.
But just to kind of keep it simple, because most victims are female and most aggressors or perpetrators are men, we say sentences, you know, indicating those genders, but it doesn't always apply. But I think that in general, though, the high profile and very common cases are men or boys. Mm-hmm. We think 18-year-olds are not yet fully grown men, but emerging adult males, mm-hmm. who basically perpetrate these crimes against girls who they consider friends, or who the girls consider friends. It's really unfortunate, and I think it's a reflection also of this notion that boys are growing up believing they are entitled to sex, and they are learning to objectify women as objects for their own sexual desires instead of entire people. And so I think it's basically a consequence of changes in our society in general, in which boys are growing up more aggressive in general, including sexually aggressive, and feel like it's okay to take advantage mm-hmm. of girls they even know or even like, because it's their right.
It's their right. That's right. You know, and what's so distressing about all of this is, then we have, and I can't help it because it's realistic, then we have somebody like Trump, who yeah. obviously is a misogynistic, you know, individual yeah. who has no respect for females. He's racist, he's classist, he's all of these things.
Yeah.
And what, I mean, and his rants are heard all over the news, you know, and all different levels of social media.
Yeah.
What impact is this having on young males, on their yeah. attitudes towards females?
That's an excellent point, and thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, and you know, we're quite concerned about it, because words matter.
Mm-hmm.
And the messages that he is espousing that are being heard by individuals can contribute to the acceptance of some of these rape myths and to some of these beliefs about attitudes toward women and the objectification of women and all of these things. I don't think Trump gets it.
I don't think
he gets what he is saying and that why what he is saying is wrong. And I think it's a scary scenario.
It is. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return shortly. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I have online from Colorado Dr. Brian Johnson and Dr. Lori Birdall. We are examining sexual aggression on the college campuses. Dr. Brian, I had to interrupt you because we were just talking about the impact of Donald Trump and his rants. Did you finish your thoughts?
Oh, I could go on for much longer, but I don't know if you have as much time in your show.
Okay.
I guess our concern is that many of these statements, we are fearful, will promote the sexualization of girls and women, and that the research is pretty clear that sexualization imposes dangerous beliefs and behaviors for both boys and girls, and it's associated with lower self-esteem for girls, early initiation in sexual activity, depression, anxiety, and other factors that make them at risk for being victimized or manipulated with partners and in relationships. And for men, it adds to this sense of entitlement to have sex. Mm-hmm. It adds to the sense that they need to be dominant and aggressive, and that they're more likely to mistreat women in their relationships too. And so I do think that these statements do matter, and I do think that they may be having a negative effect on the development of individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to say I do believe that his remarks have been incredibly damaging to females, not only in this nation, but as people around the world watch our race for the presidency.
Oh, they're probably laughing. They're sitting laughing.
Yeah, we have very good friends in Europe, and they're frightened, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that a president is someone who our children and young adults should look up to and aspire to be and will be admired. And if someone like that is a blatant sexist who bullies women, this is not going to advance women and girls' place in society, but it's going to degrade them. It's going to have far-reaching, deleterious implications for our society.
Indeed.
And I have been not only concerned about his behavior, but I've been concerned about some of his female followers, supporters' remarks about his sexist comments in which he clearly degrades women and girls. I'm not sure how to address that, but for instance, I heard a woman, it's great that people are out there and learning about their candidates and deciding who to support, but if even a woman who, particularly if she's a mother, if she hears his remarks and feels that it's just silliness,
mm-hmm.
or it's just a joke, or it doesn't matter, it's very clear that remarks from a potential world leader and the leader of a major party in our country is very clear that his or her words matter.
Yeah.
And it's unbelievable that we are in the situation we are today in which those remarks are not only accepted but supported.
That's true.
Yeah, and so I think that we need to give our, particularly our girls, the tools to reject these, sexist, stereotypical, and bullying portrayals, so that they know how to fight them. Because unfortunately, girls, until their brain is fully formed and they're able to process these sorts of assaults in ways that make them okay, I think they need help in doing that. So I think it's extremely concerning for our society. Women, after all, are people too. And I thought they were equal to men. Silly me.
Right.
But and Donald Trump even unfortunately has sexualized his own daughters.
I know. It's awful. It's awful. I mean, it, when you think about it, it's very distressing.
It is.
Yeah. It really is.
It is.
And well, we're going to stop because I could go on and on about him. Let's get back. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to, I was reading an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, and it was about campus sexual assault, and I think they were featuring the University of Tennessee. And they talked about the dangers of the red zone. And I found this, I don't know if people were familiar with this, but I wanted to get you to respond to it. And that red zone was that time at the beginning of the academic year when the statistics, for college students shoot up. They're really high. They're at the most risk for sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the number of reported assaults on campus seems to soar during the first few months. In the article, they've noted that half of the reported sexual assaults occurred between the first day of classes and Thanksgiving break. And this was reported by the National Institute of Justice. Do you have any comments on that?
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. I found it be interesting. It was just out, if you want to catch the article. It's like maybe the end of September.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my first thought was that when you go onto campus again, there's a lot of socializing.
Mm-hmm.
and you don't necessarily know people very well, and you're not necessarily involved in all, you know, heavy schoolwork, so you're going to maybe a lot more parties during that time. I don't know, but certainly there is a close association with sexual assault and parties involving alcohol and drugs. And so I wonder if that's part of it.
That's what I was thinking. Because I know for first-year students, the incidence is highest in September and October. And that was reported by the Bureau of Justice Statistics.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that makes some sense to me, too, because also that first semester, you're just starting to form your peer group.
Right.
And you're getting to know people. And one of the best ways to decrease the likelihood that you will be victimized with sexual aggression is to stay with a group of friends. And so you go to the party with the group, and you always leave with the group, and you never let one of your friends leave alone. And so if you're just getting to know people, they may not be as vigilant in watching to make sure that nothing happens to you and kind of taking care of each other.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if that might also be part of the problem, is that, you know, with a lot of these sorts of problematic behaviors, trying to get bystanders to intervene has been shown to be tremendously important in terms of reducing the frequency of some of these activities.
Yeah. And also during that time of the year, there's, I guess, there's fraternity sorority rush, you know, activities where many of these assaults have occurred. You know, formation of sports teams and activities around that sort of thing. But I think, yeah, and Brian's right about that. Teaching kids party safety is really important. And not only being with a group and staying with the group, but having, we always recommend that one person in that group is the designated sober partier. So not only do you need a designated driver, a designated sober partier who is watching the members of your group to make sure that they don't leave with someone, or they don't suddenly disappear where they might be in a dangerous situation. So somebody that, you know, has the wherewithal and sobriety, but just also the alertness. They're not just there to meet people and socialize. They're there to actually watch the members of their friend group or their peer group.
And one of the comments that had been made in that article is that when the young women go out in groups, they have developed secret hand signals. So they could look at each other, and if they were making a signal, they might say they're with somebody that, or they're even talking to someone that they feel uncomfortable with. And they make that signal, and so another party would come over and start talking and interacting, and they found that that was helpful as far as partying safely, being in,
That's great. And I think it's always good to approach it from the fact that we know that partying will occur. So if we just say, "Oh, don't party, don't drink," yeah, that may not be
that may not be.
But if you
do drink,
party, if you happen to drink, or if you happen to be, you know, trying a drug, and that's a whole other topic.
Yes.
These are your risks.
Right.
And I think to let boys know, too, that their safety is in jeopardy also when they drink and they party or use drugs in the party, because accusations of rape happen more often when the perpetrator and or the victim are under the influence. And so
exactly.
They can protect themselves because they might not have, you know, perpetrated a crime they're accused of. And so that's important too.
Why do we find that the majority of the sexual assaults on campus go unreported? Talk about that.
Yeah, that's a great point. And furthermore, why do most rapes of women go unreported? I think that's a great question. There's many, many answers. Certainly, I think for younger women, my patients anyway, they feel, for some reason, this sense of shame, and also sometimes a sense of fear from reporting. And I totally get the fear for sure, because if you look at what women, well, any sort of victim goes through when they attempt to hold their perpetrator accountable in a court of law, it's really difficult stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see where they would fear that. They also might fear repercussions, and that goes from any perpetrator who might be your male, you know, your dating partner or your spouse or anyone else who has assaulted or raped you. You might fear repercussions, but you might fear getting involved in the legal process because, after all, blaming the victim is very common. It continues to happen.
It certainly does.
And scrutinizing their lives.
And I also think that, as you were saying earlier, that a large percentage of on-campus rapes occur among acquaintances.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, people, I think that sometimes young women, and in some cases young men, don't want to get the perpetrator in trouble. They even though they did not like what happened to them and didn't want what happened to them happen, they also don't want to get the person that they know, their acquaintance, perhaps a mutual friend, in trouble. And so I think they also avoid dealing with it more officially or legally for those kinds of reasons as well.
Or they might fear rejection by their peer group. I mean, if it's a part of a society they belong to or a group, of friends. And they also might fear not being believed.
That's true.
Yeah. So there's so many reasons.
There's a lot. Yeah.
I think it doesn't go reported, and I wish that all young women would realize that it's never their fault. And it's never okay. I don't care how they dressed. I don't care if they flirted or not. I don't care if they thought they were gonna, they wanted to have sex, but then they changed their mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, none of those are an okay reason to be assaulted or raped. And I wish that we could impart courage into our girls, but we might have to reform our justice system and reporting protocols on campuses in order to really enable that to happen. Because unfortunately, as we hear from, cases in the news, oftentimes victims are still blamed or
That's very, very, very common.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the Not Alone Project?
No. What's that?
Well, it's a project. It's a federal project that's backed by President Obama, and they strive to break the silence about sexual violence on campus, and they're reaching out to provide support, kind of reclaim justice and security and sense of well-being, for those who have experienced an attack. I found it, I don't know a lot about it, but I know it is something that I think started in 2015. I'm not quite sure. Something like that.
Sounds like a valuable project. We'll have to check that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Not Alone Project.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's great.
As we look,
like it's a way to empower victims of sexual aggression to become more proactive and, like you say, taking back their safety and their sense of security.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The U.S. is somewhat unique in that it's the only crime where there are statutory protections designed in favor of the victim. And these rape shield laws is what I'm thinking of, that prohibit a cross-examination in the issues of prior sexual history,
yeah,
or the way she was or he was dressed at a time. And I wanted to mention that, Dr. Lori, when you were talking about that.
Right.
Yeah. So
right,
that is one unique thing about the United States and our position on it. What role can parents play? And when I say what role can they play, I mean advice that they can offer their young people, even though they're adults, they still have a long way to go. But what advice can they offer about campus safety? And I know some parents still track their daughters on their cell phones. You know, that's one thing that they have been doing. You know, and even like when we were talking about parties, if you're going to party and you are going to drink, make sure you don't take a drink from someone else. And if you have a drink, if you're going to drink a beer, then you get the beer and you open the beer.
That's exactly right. And you don't leave it unattended.
Right.
You put your hand on the top the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Not drinking. Yep.
So anything else, any other roles that you think that the parents, you know, can play?
Yeah. Well, I think that this is a great time to bring up the number one protective factor that, that parents have in their arsenal to protect kids against all forms of violence and aggression, and that is having a close relationship with their kids. Despite the turbulent teen time, when there will be some natural withdrawal, you know, and separation, which is a good, healthy thing usually, but to maintain that relationship so that there's a level of trust where kids know that their parents do things because they care and they really do have their back and they really do want to help and they want kids to come to them even in college, even, you know, in early adulthood with problems so they can help. And that close relationship will greatly increase the chance that kids will heed your advice as a parent, ask for advice, and, you know, and so that's your number one protective factor is keeping that relationship close so that they'll, you know, heed your advice.
You're tuned into 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other folks. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. What's the 411? You're tuned into 411 Teen, and Dr. Lori was talking about parents and relationships and what they can do as far as sexual aggression for their young students in college. Dr. Lori, would you continue? I'm sorry I had to interrupt you.
Oh, no problem. So I think the next thing is to address safety concerns out of the fact that you care, not out of wanting to control. And we were talking a little bit ago about, you know, saying, well, you know, you will not party, you will not drink, you know,
that's not reasonable.
Yeah, that's not the way to go, just because then it looks like a control sort of thing instead of a concern thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then also just saying something as simple as, hey, you know, and I want you to know that it's never okay to be frightened or pressured or forced into having sex of any kind, and that you want to know if it happens because you want to open that door to coming to you with that, you know, problem so that, again, you can help and address it. Instead of wishing it away or just saying, well, I know this won't happen, but, you know, just say it. You know, it's never okay if someone does this to you. It's never your fault, and I want to know if it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, we talked already about teaching party safety, but also, you know, street smart. It's, boy, I remember in college and in grad school and stuff going, well, you know, yeah, it's dark and no one's around me, but I'll just go ahead and, you know, walk across campus real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not necessarily anymore. You know, I mean, it depends, but to teach, you know, kind of being aware of your surroundings, you know, when to be concerned, that kind of stuff. But also self-defense, because assaults and rapes seem to be more and more of a problem. Newer research is showing that defending oneself against an assault is actually a good thing, even though it might seem scary that generally we shouldn't fear being harmed more by resisting.
Right.
We should go ahead and do so.
And scream and holler and make all the commotion that you possibly
can. Absolutely, and kick
and do everything.
Yep.
Right.
And I also think as a parent, you know, oftentimes parents have some interaction with roommates or people on your child's dorm floor, or, you know, people who are your children's friends. And, you know, if you have that opportunity and you can, you know, take some of your child's roommates or friends out to a lunch or a dinner and even have that conversation, hey, guys, I hope you're looking out for each other. When you go to parties, I hope you're, you know, protecting each other and making sure no one gets hurt, and just kind of making those kinds of statements to your child's broader social network can also plant the seed, and it can also help form a relationship that you could start having with people who are important to your child.
Yeah, and I think one more quick thing would be having discussions about the risks of casual sex outside of romantic relationships. These booty calls and friends with benefits and all that sort of thing. That actually does increase the risk, especially for women, of being assaulted. And so to not just assume that they know, to actually go there. I mean, have these conversations. You'll get the roll of the eyes, hopefully, and, you know, oh, Mom, I know, or whatever. But to have those conversations so that they know that you know, and you want to talk about it, and you want to give them, you know, information to so that they can protect themselves.
And as we're looking at parenting, also the use of what I call, I guess, the gender balance parenting,
yes,
particularly for young men.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yep. I think that that's something that we really need to make sure is happening in our homes now.
Yes. Young men learn how to treat, you know, women by the way that they see men in their families and in their lives treat moms and aunts and relatives. And so you're absolutely right that the men in young men's lives are very important role models to be able to demonstrate respect for women and this shared caring for children and all that goes along with that.
We talk about the sexual aggression being usually committed by someone you know or know of. And if it's someone that you're having a relationship with, there are some indicators that one needs to be aware of. And when I talk about those indicators, I mean things about just how they interact with you on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I mean, the tone of their voice, controlling statements, and all of that. And I wanted to ask you to elaborate on that and talk about some of those indicators, maybe indicators of what may be emotional abuse.
Yeah, that's a great topic. And that falls under the area of dating violence, but that can also progress to domestic violence, where a couple is actually cohabitating, may or may not be married. But I think that it's very concerning if a couple is in a relationship and one partner is demonstrating with repetitive behaviors that he or she wants to be in control of the partner's activities, friendships, and decisions. And that, you know, sometimes can get confused as, oh, you know,
they love me.
He calls me all the time and texts me what I'm doing because he cares.
Yeah, he cares. He loves me.
Yeah. No, not so much.
Mm-mm.
If he cared, he would support your individual interests and individual friendships and treat you like an equal. And so this constant sort of texting or checking on, you know, is one indicator that can kind of be missed or misconstrued. It's always, I think, a little easier, but still can go, you know, and treat it as acceptable when a partner actually hits, you know, their partner to exert control. But even then, sometimes, unfortunately, especially girls, but also boys, can be misconstrued as as caring. And I think then there's a definite connection between being abused in the home or seeing and witnessing domestic violence and learning that that's, you know, that's the way we show, you know, that we care. It's a really dangerous, you know, slippery slope. But as far as sexual aggression within a romantic relationship, I've heard from many of my younger adolescent patients who say, well, you know, he says that, you know, we need to do it more because that's how I show my love for him.
Right. Yeah. I've heard that, too.
Not so much.
Or even the violence during sex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, well, he was just playing around. I mean, he gets like that sometimes.
Right, right, exactly,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yep, and then, you know, parents should be concerned if their child is anxious about parents being around the partner very
mm-hmm.
much or knowing what's going on and being afraid of letting the partner know about something they did, an activity they did or something, so that would indicate a level of dangerous control.
And I think as a parent, a warning sign would be that, you know, the abusive partner is limiting your child's interactions with
mm-hmm.
you. And they are, you know, controlling your child
to
the point where you're not having as much interaction and it's inconvenient for you to get to be with them and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so those would be some of the warning signs that you would look for as a parent. If your child may be falling into that type of a dynamic or that sort of a relationship.
Or if they use pejorative language.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
You know, calling them stupid, you idiot, you this,
yeah.
you,
yeah.
Being demeaning towards
mm-hmm.
your partner, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, again, a lot of times, you know, the victim in this situation will not be sharing those sorts of behaviors with the parent.
No.
And so that's where, you know, again, they might share it with a friend, and that's where the bystander needs to step in and say, you know what, this isn't good for you. I'm worried about you. I'm worried, you know, about your safety. You know, do you have a plan? What if this escalates? What if this, you know, turns to something physical? What will you do? And actually try to help, you know, the victim figure out a plan and to reality test with them and that this is not okay.
Well, Dr. Brian, that leads right into the question of what someone should do. If they know someone who has been sexually assaulted or is in a relationship where they feel they are being sexually assaulted. And I think the biggest thing is they need to encourage them to talk about it.
Right.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Victims need support, and
mm-hmm.
And part of that is the reality testing that Brian just talked about. This is not normal loving behavior.
Right.
This is abuse, and it's not okay, and you don't deserve it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You are a valuable person, and you deserve to be treated well. And sometimes it can be hard. And oftentimes victims will be defensive. And so people
mm-hmm.
who try to help need to be aware that, you know, to expect that, but to and to maybe just use small doses of something, you know, they may not feel as defensive about,
mm-hmm.
and to try not to attack the perpetrator's character or personally attack that person, because a lot of times the victim will try to defend them, but to more talk about the behaviors that are happening that are bad for the victim and that they care about the victim and they want better for them, and couldn't they maybe think about talking to someone else, or here's a website, or you know, I worry about you, please call me
mm-hmm.
if you want to talk, or have you told your parents? You know, what do you think they would say? Do you think they would want you to be treated this way? You know, things like that.
Indeed, yes. The effects are the consequences of sexual assault. Can we address those in these last few minutes that we have? And, of course, we know it could be death, it can be injury, and be sexually transmitted diseases. But I'm talking about the serious psychological trauma.
Yeah. There are many, and it's mm-hmm. a really important thing. Sexual assault is no small problem. It has long-lasting repercussions for the victims, which creates all sorts of problems for the future, and really harms the society because it affects victims' mental health.
Yeah.
Depression and anxiety naturally result from being victimized, from sexual abuse, just like it would from being shot by a gun.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And also can result in a serious mental illness, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, which has incredibly bad repercussions for life. It can result in substance use and abuse, mm-hmm. Trying to forget or trying to cover up those horrendous feelings of fear, and lead people to actually sometimes put themselves in situations where they become victimized again.
Again, that's right.
Yeah, and I think even when they do get into a loving, caring relationship, it can make it difficult for them to trust the other person and to be fully part of that relationship. And so even when they are able to find a healthy relationship, they still have struggles within those types of relationships as well.
What support services are available to victims?
I mean, I think there are a lot of support services in mm-hmm. various communities mm-hmm. For victims. And certainly, if someone has been victimized who's listening, they could contact the community mental health center in their community. They could contact local university counseling centers. Even if they're not a student, the counseling center would likely have a referral list of agencies in the community that offer types of supports for victims of sexual aggression.
Mm-hmm. And then there's RAIN, which is the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, RAINN. That has lots of information and assistance on their website, as well as the National Sexual Assault Hotline, which is 1-800-656-HOPE, H-O-P-E, or 4673. You can talk to someone confidentially. They have a referral service for survivors of sexual assault. And we can't forget that victims can even think about suicide.
Yes,
and, can commit that, and mm-hmm. And so we have to take it extremely seriously. They need professional follow up and help, and friends, even if they think that their victim friend is resistant at first, still be there. Try to get them to see that they deserve, assistance to recover from this.
Yeah, just continue to encourage them. And another thing with the sexual assault, even professors or fellow students may notice that the student's ability to cope mm-hmm. Is expressed in their academic, their social, and their personal functioning. You may see it deteriorating, okay?
Yes.
You may have a student, and I had this, actually. I had a student who was a good student all the way around and everything across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And her grades just started to deteriorate.
Mm.
She wasn't coming to class, and she seemed disinterested, and her affect had changed. Her general appearance had changed. And to make a long story short, she was in a relationship where she was experiencing sexual abuse by her maid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and she didn't know where to go or what to do, and just did not or was not able to cope with it. And we are out of time. Will you please share your book and where we can get it real quick?
Yes. So it's warning signs, how to protect your kids from becoming victims or perpetrators of violence and aggression. It's available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and an audio book is available from Vibrance Press. And anyone who's interested in more information, and we have a huge list of resources for all sorts of problems encountered by youth and parents on our website at warningsignsforparents.com.
Many thanks to Dr. Johnson and Burdall. That's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.